radio shows, we talk about that. Mostly on this show, we talk about the people who call in and what's going on with it, what's going on for the week, and what your voice can really tell you. We did another set of kids over the weekend. Heather, you didn't work this weekend.
From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here at the People Speak, we know that when the people speak, we can make a difference. Tonight, the people speak with Father Brian Koldacek. Father Brian was a Canadian-born, joined the Missionaries of the Charity of Fathers upon their inception in 1984. He was ordained in 1985 at the Ukrainian Catholic Church of St. John the Baptist in Newark, New Jersey, USA. By the late Metropolitan Archbishop of Winnipeg, Maxim Hermach, I believe is how it is pronounced. Father Brian received a BA in philosophy from St. Michael's College of the University of Toronto, Canada in 1977, and an MA in philosophy from the University of Manitoba, Canada. He is also a PhD in organizational psychology with Saybrook Institute, San Francisco. And currently, as we speak, he is the postulator for the canonization of Mother Teresa. Hello, Father. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you.
I hope I pronounced your name correctly, Father.
Pretty close, actually. Koldacek.
Koldacek, okay. And may they, in fact, call you Father Brian.
We don't use the last name, so Father Brian is good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That is an incredible honor in and of itself to be the postulator of such an incredible sister as the Blessed Teresa of Calcutta, which is her official name, if I'm not mistaken. Right, Father?
Right, now it's since October 19th, 2003, she's known as officially as Blessed Teresa of Calcutta.
Now, as a blessed, she is not officially sainted as of yet, or canonized as a saint, is she?
No, that's beatification or becoming blessed is an ultimate step. So one more step is to have a miracle that can be verified that has occurred through her intercession, through her prayer, or someone asks Mother Teresa to pray for this intention, and then God does that miracle. And then once that can be verified, then the next and the final step is the canonization. And
I see. This is a very long and arduous process. Can you help us to understand exactly what's involved in the canonization of an individual, especially one the time element that's involved?
Okay. Well, normally there's like three overall steps, three basic steps. And the canonization process is something that actually starts from the bottom up, as it were. So the person, a possible candidate for sainthood, has to have a solid reputation of holiness among the people. And so once that can be established, we say we look for a solid and widespread reputation of holiness and intercessory power, which means that people have a sense that this person lived an exemplary Christian life, and that also people are praying and asking her intercession and getting positive results. Because once we establish that, then the formal process like the church's discernment of what is among the people. And then, so that's the second step. And then the third step is the miracle. So no matter how perfectly we can try to do the process, there's always a chance, even though it might be a very slight chance, that there was something that no one discovered that would be an obstacle to canonization. And therefore, a miracle is considered to be God's confirmation of the Church's discernment of what is among the people. So that's roughly, in broad strokes, the overall process. And then the canonization process itself has three steps. I don't know if you want me to go through them briefly as well.
I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what's involved. So, yeah, if you could briefly elaborate on that, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. So the formal process as well has three steps. So the first step is to gather the information about the, we say, an inquiry into the life, the virtues, and reputation of holiness of the servant of God. So we did that for Mother Teresa, we did that in the beginning in 1999, so that in 2 years' time, with a lot of people working, we were able to collect the testimony from 113 people, and then many documents, so that the combination of the testimony and the documents was about 83 volumes of an average 400 to 450 pages a volume. So roughly it was 35,000 pages we had collected, so in 2 years' time. And then, so that material was the principal inquiry, the principal seat of that, the inquiry on the level of the diocese, was in Calcutta. And witnesses were heard in different other places around the world, and it was all gathered with the documents and then sent to Rome. So the first phase is the gathering of the information based on testimony, personal people's first-hand or second-hand experience with Mother Teresa, and the documents. So once that was done, we did that in 2 years' time. Then the next step was, then all of that goes to Rome. So we move from the diocesan phase, which was in Calcutta, to the Roman phase. And there, the first step in the Roman phase was the congregation, the Vatican Congregation for the Cause of Saints, had to verify that the inquiry was done according to the norms, so that everything was done properly. Once that was done, then the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, appoints what's called a relator. And that's an official in the congregation that oversees the writing of the study of about what was collected. So if the inquiry, the gathering of the information, was on the life, virtues, and reputation of holiness, then the study has to as well present Mother Teresa's life, virtues, and reputation of holiness. And so this is called in Latin a positio. The basic, or roughly the translation in English would be called a position. So the basic question is, what position can one take as to whether Mother Teresa lived a heroic Christian life? And that positio was done under the supervision of the relator in the congregation, and then the other part, kind of the external collaborator, was myself. Then we had another team of people, and we were able to make a 5,000-page positio in just under a year. And so once that was done, then it went to the evaluation of 9 theologians. And the theologians, once they read the positio, they can say, yes, we, on the basis of this study, well, first they could have said they could have asked questions. Well, what about this? This wasn't explained well. We have a question about that. This part is weak. Please come back and tell us more, or fill in that blank, or whatever they might have said. So they have that chance. But in this case, so the 9 theologians, headed by the person who was called the promoter of faith. And in the old terminology, the promoter of faith was commonly known as the devil's advocate. Okay, so I can go back and explain a little bit what happened, because many people heard about this. If they know anything about the cause of canonization, they always mention the devil's advocate. So I can go back just once I finish outlining the process. So
very interesting.
A committee of 9 theologians, headed by the promoter of faith, has to vote yes or no or they can also have a suspended vote. I'm not convinced one way or the other. And for the process, so for Mother Teresa's beatification to move forward, at least two-thirds of those nine, so six out of nine, had to have a yes vote. In our case, they were all nine unanimous. Once the theologians give their vote, at least the two-thirds, then that same positio and the report of the theologians. So the theologian, each one, has to make a report on why they voted as they voted. So that report is printed up, all the reports of the nine is printed up, sent along with the positio to another group of cardinals and bishops, around 15 or 20, and they also have to read the reports of the theologians and the positio, and then they also have to be at least two-thirds positive. Once they're two-thirds positive, then that goes finally to the Pope, and then the Pope makes the final decision whether he accepts that work. And then if he says yes, then the person is able to be called venerable because they are considered to have lived a heroic Christian life. Then after that is the miracle. Okay? So before going to the miracle, may I just go back to the person of the devil's advocate. So before, in 1983, the process was somewhat streamlined so that many of the complaints, especially in the Second Vatican Council, many complaints were that this process took so long that by the time it went through, sometimes decades of work, that particular person may have lost some of the resonance for the people, the relevance or the attractiveness of that person for the particular time. So they didn't want to lose any of the rigor of the investigation, but they wanted to make it as solid but and streamlined as they could. When there was a devil's advocate, promoter of faith, it was more a sense of a trial. And so in the reform, they wanted to make it more attuned to when it was done in the 20th century. The science, especially the science of history, and that's why they changed it to not just say for a recent cause, someone recently dead. It was not just about not just using the testimony, but also the documents. So they didn't lose the rigor, but they made it a little bit faster. So, but still, the devil's advocate role was not left just like towards the end, when it finally got to the theologians, but already in the diocese, in that first stage, there's the episcopal delegate, so it's really the diocese of the bishop of the place that does the inquiry, and he appoints an episcopal delegate, his delegate, who actually does it, and then the episcopal delegate the person is called the promoter of justice. So the promoter of justice is the one who has to make sure that the process is being done well, honestly, nothing is trying to be put under the carpet or hidden or covered up or whatever. So that's that person's job. So there is the first stage where these things are checked. Then one of the main functions of the relator, who oversees the preparation of the positio, is also to make sure especially that any doubt or any possible negative point is looked into. And then finally, when it gets to the group of nine theologians, they also, another place that they can see if there's anything missing or whatever they want to say to make sure that everything is being considered. Okay? So that's kind of the first. And the examination of holiness. And then once that's done, then they also look at the miracle. So the miracle covers basically the same process. You gather the information, you get the witnesses, you get the medical opinions, then the positio is written up about the case. So they look for the in every case they look for the diagnosis, prognosis, the therapy, what treatment, if any, was given, intercession. At what point did anyone pray? In this case, to Mother Teresa. And then fifth is the cure. What happened if the person got unexpectedly better? After the positio, then it goes to a panel of five doctors. And the doctors are there to say, the doctors don't decide if it's a miracle. They just have to explain whether they find that there's no medical or scientific explanation for the cure. Then it goes to the group of theologians, seven theologians, who make the connection. They have to determine that there's a connection between this inexplicable cure and the intercession to Mother Teresa. Once that is done, then it goes to a group of cardinals and theologians. They also have to be at least two-thirds. And then it finally goes to the Pope, who gives the last word. So roughly that's the process.
Well, you know, that is an incredible process in and of itself. Can I ask you, Father Brian, what were the circumstances that you met Mother... Hello? Can you hear me, Father? Father, can you hear me?
Fatima, you're there?
Just a minute.
Hello?
I'm afraid we're having some technical difficulties.
This land was made for you and me. There was a high wall there that tried to stop me. And there was a sign that said, it said private property. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. Oh, no, that sign was made for you and me. And the sun came shining when I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and a voice was chanting that the fog was lifting. Yeah, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief of the fast summer people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me.
Confidant of Mother Teresa. Father, we apologize for the technical difficulties that we suffered, but you were coming through loud and clear, and everybody heard everything that you said. I just wanted to assure you of that.
Okay, good.
May I ask you, how did you actually meet Mother Teresa, sir?
My sister joined the Missionaries of Charity in 1977, and sorry, 1976. And then the following year, 1977, my parents and I went to Rome to see her. In those days, that's where the formation was. And this was in May of 77. And there, Mother Teresa happened to be in Rome and staying at the convent. And so we were staying nearby, and we would go for the morning mass and prayer time in the afternoon and help the sisters. So Mother Teresa knew that I was the brother of one of her sisters. And then at that time, a group of contemplative brothers were beginning in Rome. We were at the opening ceremony. And the ceremony, part of it was this first group at Mother Teresa pinned a cross on the shoulder of each one during the mass. And then as we were leaving, my parents said goodbye. It was my turn, and then I was greeting her. Then she said to me, "Oh, I want to pin a cross on you too." And then from that, then I didn't say anything, and my big shock. And so only the next day I saw her in the convent, and then she explained a little. She thought maybe I had a vocation for the MC and that group of brothers. So and then I joined in 1977, and so since then I was, apart from 2 years when I left of that group for a couple of years, and then later joined the father's group that began in 84. So I was always in a place, whether it was Rome or later in the Bronx in New York, and then later in Tijuana, where Mother Teresa would come quite often, once or twice or even more times a year. So through that way, I got to know her quite well.
How did she affect your life? I mean, knowing the way you did now in the aftermath of her life, you have become, not only were you a confidant to her during her lifetime, you've become the very process maker for what is going to actually create a saint out of her. How do you feel about that? How has this affected your life, Father Brian?
Well, certainly, no idea when I was just a young man of 21 when I first met Mother Teresa. I had no idea of anything that was going to come later. But it was certainly a wonderful privilege and honor and grace to have even met her and then known her for those years. And then, even more so, was doing all this work because, you know, one of the great things of it was gathering all this information and putting it together in the Positio, where you maybe really in a way that I haven't, or maybe most other people haven't before, was able to see like a more complete picture of Mother Teresa. So while, you know, our experience of our own personal experience, those who knew her, we had kind of one, you know, sometimes I say it's something like, you know, I had my piece of the pie and someone else had another piece of the pie and another piece of the pie, being each one's own, you know, experience and relationship to her. And then by doing this work, and you have a much more complete picture of Mother Teresa, and perhaps in a way, in a real way, knowing her better after than when she was living.
That's an interesting perspective. You know, one of the most important things that I felt Mother Teresa's life said was, for instance, there was a hospice that she had started called Khalijat, the home of the pure heart. Mm-hmm. During it, those that were receiving medical attention were offered an opportunity to die with dignity no matter what their faith. Muslims were read the Quran, Hindus were received water from the Ganges, mm-hmm. Catholics received the last rites, mm-hmm. and I believe her statement was, a beautiful death is for mm-hmm. people who live like animals to die like angels, loved
right.
and wanted.
Yeah. Right. That was
Father, what do you think that the modern-day Christian evangelists that are so divisive in their stand, in their position today, would say about someone as incredible as Mother Teresa?
Well, I think her attitude was for herself. I mean, she, in one way, I describe her as a woman passionately in love with Jesus. And so for her, Jesus was her treasure, her everything. and she would wish that others would also share in the treasure, on one hand. On the other hand, you know, as you say, in all of the work of the missionaries of charity around the world, there was not discrimination in a way of we're serving you because you are this or you're not this or whatever, so that everyone, you know, was treated as a child of God, so that in no way there was any imposition of or Christian faith or Catholic faith. Each one was respected. If anyone would ever wish to share in what was for her her treasure, that was also fine, but there was never any pressure, just the full respect for that person and their particular beliefs.
She was indeed an amazing woman. She had no fear of powerful people. She met presidents, kings, queens, leaders of nations. What did she think of them? I mean, I know what everybody in the world thought of Mother Teresa, but what did she think of them?
One of the things, you know, that we noticed, the ones who were more close, was, especially the sisters who were always accompanying her, was that her attitude in front of the queen or the president was the same as someone in, say, Kaligat, the home for the dying. You know, and that, at this, many people would say, you know, when I was with Mother Teresa, it seemed like I was the only person in the world at that moment. She was giving me her full attention, her full concern, that at that moment I was the most important person. So I think that attitude was transmitted with whomever she met. And so, in that sense, everyone was alike.
Well, it absolutely showed in many of the interviews that she had with them. When you were with Mother Teresa, what were the things that most attracted people to her? I mean, she was, from all intents and purposes, an ordinary woman that reached out to anybody. Mm-hmm. What did you see when she was with other people?
Well, you know, that was exactly what you're saying. You know, that's the same thing. And I used to say sometimes, think or say to others, you know, if you went into the convent and you didn't know what Mother Teresa looked like, you might not guess at all who it was, precisely because she seemed to be so ordinary, down to earth. You know, sometimes people have the idea that the saints are like up in the clouds and, you know, kind of just hardly you can keep their feet on the ground. But on the contrary, you know, Mother Teresa was very much with her feet on the ground. Very simple, very ordinary. And I think especially, like, I knew her more in, the last 20 years of her life. So that when she was already a little bit older. And, you know, one of the strong characteristics that we and her followers felt and other people felt was especially this motherly quality. You know, that, even commonly, you know, those who knew her a little better would call her mother. We didn't even say Mother Teresa all the time. We would say, well, good morning, mother. Or in our writing or speaking, we just referred to her as mother. And they really felt that, you know, each one and my own personal thing, that I felt like it was I had another mother. It's that same tenderness, the same concern, and, you know, she was like super observant. She would be able to pick out things in a crowd and people in a crowd and say, particularly needy in a crowd that everyone else would miss. You know, for example, we were once in the airport, and I think it was in Rome, and, you know, she would... airline people would bring her into a little room and waiting for the flight, and then suddenly the MPs would come along with her. Then people would come and greet her, and she would give a little medal. And and then one time she was about to go, so we were all standing. She got up, we were all standing around, and then way behind all the people around her, she noticed someone who was kind of keeping back and looked a little bit sad. So that she made the effort, she picked that person out of the crowd and went over to make sure that she greeted that person, and you know, she had a way of holding the hand, rubbing the hands a little bit of the other person, so that this person all said, well, you know, Mother Teresa came and saw me, and she made the effort to go come and greet me. And so there's those little things that really showed that the real humanist.
Well, and obviously that's, I'm sure that's part of the reason that she did actually win the Nobel Prize for Humanitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
How did she feel about that? What were her thoughts about winning that?
Well, actually, the story goes that I think she got the news like in the middle of the night. One sister phoned her up and said, you just won a Nobel Peace Prize, and she said, oh, that's good, and then I'll go back to sleep. So on one hand, you know, the awards and all those honors, she had the attitude that personally they were, for her, they weren't important, but they were important more not to recognize her person, but rather the work, and especially, she would say, all these prizes and awards are honoring the poor and bringing attention to the poor and to their needs, and so in this way that they would be better known, better loved, and then to be able to help. So on one hand, very detached, and on the other hand, she appreciated the opportunity that those awards gave her to bring attention to the people and the beauty and the dignity and the needs of the poor.
Father Brian, the story was that Mother Teresa, in her very early years, heard within her spirit the voice of Jesus Christ call her to her ultimate calling to work with the poor. Did she ever speak to you about any of this?
Actually, that was one of the things that she refused to speak about. Some people would ask, and she would just say, and she wouldn't say anything or change the subject, or she would just say it was a call within a call. Only later on, when we were doing the work for the beatification and canonization, we discovered that some of the few Jesuits had preserved some of those early letters from the beginning of the congregation of Jesuit Charity, from 1946 onward. And in those letters, we discovered that the call came through what we call an interior locution, meaning that very clearly, very distinctly, she heard within, not coming from the outside, but she heard from within the voice of Jesus. And there's two letters which she wrote to the Archbishop of Calcutta at the time, Archbishop Perrier, and outlining the message that Jesus was giving her. And in one of them, even there's a real sense of dialogue. And there's Jesus' words as she reports them. Then she said, I said this. And then he came back and he said this. And, so later on, in one of her letters to Archbishop Perrier, just a few years later, she heard that another bishop who was having a congregation of sisters begin in his diocese wanted to find out, how did the Mother Teresa's sisters begin. So when she heard that, she wrote a letter begging the archbishop not to give anything of the beginning, these personal kind of these letters. And then because she said, once people will know about me, once they know about the beginning, they will think more about me and less of Jesus. So that she didn't want anyone to know anything about what happened or that it was special or the locutions, that she didn't want any attention on anything about her, but that she said, it will be more on me and less on Jesus.
Very interesting. What an amazing woman she was. May I ask you, the process, again, getting back to the canonization of Mother Teresa, did you actually advocate or were you selected? And are you a member of Opus Dei? Is that part of the because I know they're very conservative and very involved with the canonization process.
No, actually, how it works is that there needs to be a person or a group who presents or promotes the person for beatification and canonization. Normally, for those who belong to a religious order, it's the order themselves who does it because they have an interest, they have the personnel. So in our case, I don't belong to Opus Dei. I belong to the Mission of the Charity Fathers. So there's the sisters who began. Then there's the active brothers, began in Calcutta in 63. And there's the contemplative brothers branch. Then there's the contemplative sisters branch. And then finally, in 84, was the final the foundation of Mother Teresa, and that was the priest branch. So I belong to the priest branch. So I happened to be in Rome at the time, in our house in Rome, in the beginning of 96, or 97, when Mother Teresa died, I was in Rome. And shortly thereafter, the Archbishop of Calcutta asked the Congregation for the Saints for permission to begin earlier than the 5 years minimum waiting time, because already very widespread and solid reputation of holiness Mother Teresa had in her lifetime already. So the congregation only answered a year later, in 98. But in the meantime, they said, you can begin the remote preparation for the cause by getting the documents organized and those kind of, just the preparatory work. So the Archbishop of Calcutta appointed two sisters and myself to do that work. And then the Congregation for Saints every year offers a four-month course for those who are involved in some way in any cause. So I was taking that course of 97-98, and during that course, that's when we came to know that the Pope was making an exception to the five-year rule. And so since I was in that course, I already had some knowledge, and because of my academic background, so they chose me to be the postulator.
How much did you actually travel with Mother Teresa?
Sorry, I didn't get the question. It wasn't clear.
I was saying I know that you traveled extensively with her, and although you've also led a very busy life on your own. How much time did you actually spend with Mother Teresa in the last years?
Well, I never spent, say, an extensive time in Calcutta or lived where she was living, or Calcutta. But I did, as I said earlier. Often I was in Rome. She would come several times a year, or in New York. She would come quite often to the United States. And then later, when we moved to Tijuana in 1988, the Fathers, then also she was there. So there were, say she would come to Rome or New York. She'd be there for a week or more, and then she'd go travel, say, in Europe, and she'd come back to Rome. And so we had the custom of I was going to the airport to pick her up, bringing her to the airport. And on other little occasions, I was there. And then also my sister's a sister. So that's also, she knew my parents. So my parents would sometimes write to her. And she would actually write back. My parents were surprised sometimes. Oh, I was, and I got an answer. So,
how wonderful. She sounds like an incredible woman. And obviously she would have had to be to be so revered and so honored in her career. We have a couple of audience members that have questions for you, Father Brian.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Our first question is from Steve from Santa Fe. Steve, you have a question for Father Brian.
Yes, Father Brian, first of all, thank you very much for taking time out of your daily life to sit here and talk to us. And I don't mean to be disrespectful by no means, but at least controversial. Isn't there some controversy over exactly what Mother Teresa did? And I don't think it speaks so much about Mother Teresa. She was known, I'm told, in Calcutta is the angel of death. She helped people die.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, she was the representative of the richest organization in the world that could have helped people to not die from dysentery, to not die from the various diseases the people died from. Is this taken in consideration in her canonization? Thank you,
well,
sir.
I say that Mother Teresa herself understood that she had one very particular call. So, you know, people would ask her some kind, a similar kind of a question, and saying, "Well, you know, and you know, you don't do anything about the causes of poverty or the structures or anything about changing the structures." And then she would say that, you know, her particular work was to give immediate and effective care to the person who was needy right now at this moment. And that it was, she couldn't do everything, but that her call was to do this part. So that others in the church or outside of the church, it was their task or their responsibility or their call to do other kind of work and look more at the causes and be concerned about that. That was also wonderful and necessary, but that her call was, in the meantime, the people who were immediately in need and maybe who would never benefit from any change in the causes or the structures or the those aspects, that her call was the immediate need and that person right here and now who needs help and needs assistance.
I think, Father Brian, too, many times, and there was some controversy going on with both Mother Teresa and obviously of the last few years within the Catholic Church itself. How did she feel about this controversy?
You know, she was well aware of the weaknesses or even the sins of others. And, you know, but her, I mean, she was well aware, and, but she would not, you know, judge those people. I mean, it's one thing to say this is wrong. How God will see that in the end, that's what we cannot say. So, and she wasn't naive in that sense. She was very well aware of the weak side and the sinfulness of different people or that's in the church as well, but you know, I think her attitude was not to judge, to pray for, and then in whatever way, by her own life, that she could in some very small way counteract that. That was also maybe a fruit of or a side effect of her own life and work, but her. Her focus was on her own call, her own vocation, and being as faithful to it as she could be.
We're speaking this evening with Father Brian Kolodacek, who is the postulator for the canonization of Mother Teresa. Excuse me, for those of you that would like to speak to him, our phone lines are open, internationally toll-free, 888-228-4494. Our next question, Father, is from Mike from California.
Okay.
Hello, Father Brian.
Hello,
I'm really curious as to what kind of person Mother Teresa is, because we always have this saintly picture of her. What did she think was funny? You know, did she ever have a favorite TV show? What kind of music did she like?
Right.
What kind of food did she like?
Right.
What did she do to relax? Because I can imagine her work was very stressful. I mean, dealing with people all day long who are dying or who are the poorest of the poor, I mean, that must weigh upon a person after a while. Thank you.
Very good question. Okay, no, Mother Teresa actually had a very good sense of humor, and she liked to tell jokes. And, you know, that one of the things some of the witnesses who also remarked was precisely on her humanness. You know, she liked ice cream, and she liked chocolate, and she had even the custom of, I think, because her own father, when she was just a young girl, her own father, before he died, used to travel quite a bit. He was a businessman. So the father had the custom of always coming back with a gift. So Mazrisa did the same. So whenever she went from one house to another house, that she would bring something, usually chocolates. So then sometimes even the joke was that, you know, we'd have one box of chocolates, and then one house would give that box of chocolates to one community of the sisters, and they'd say, oh, well, we better keep this in case we have to get we ourselves have to give a gift. So that the joke at least was that you never know when that same box of chocolates was going to come all the way around, but again, make full circle, and going around from house to house. But Mother Teresa was very, and that's a very ordinary, and as I said, a real sense of humor. She liked telling jokes or telling funny stories of things that happened. And you know, when you were near the convent in the evening, they had what's called recreation period, usually from 8:30 to 9 before the 9 o'clock night prayer, and they'd get ready and go to bed. But at 8:30 to 9 recreation period, and then on Sundays and on Thursdays it was an hour, a little bit longer. You know, if you were anywhere near there, everyone remarked on all the real laughter that was coming from where the sisters were having recreation. And you know, say mother house in the main house in Calcutta, when there was over 300. So if you happen to be there in the house at say around between 8:30 and 9, and all the different sisters were having recreation at the same time, it was a very loud place filled with a lot of laughing and of the sisters.
So there you go, folks. Mother Teresa was involved in some rabble-rousing, at least on occasion. Our next question, Father, is from Mary from Northern California. Mary, okay. Thank you. Your question for Father Brian.
Hello, Father Brian. I'd just like to ask this one little question. After seeing the poverty and overpopulation in India, did she ever tell you how she personally felt about the church's stand on birth control? Not abortion, but the actual prevention of pregnancy.
Okay, actually, the sisters would be trained in natural family planning, which mostly was the Binnens method. So that, you know, she followed the church's teaching on the non-use of artificial contraception, and so the sisters were involved in natural family planning.
So it was actually they were advocates of the natural planning process.
Mm-hmm.
And they taught this throughout the just in India.
In India and in other places where they were, the sisters were involved in, not in every house, but where they were able to, or that there was a possibility or other people doing it, then they would be involved in that, yes.
Very interesting. Again, our telephone number here, folks, is, let me see here, it's 1-888-228-4494 for those of you that want to speak to Father Brian about Mother Teresa. Please give us a call at the People Speak Radio Show. Thank you. Our next question is from Steve from Santa Fe again. Steve, I see you're very interested in talking to Father. Come right ahead.
Oh. I saw her drop the mic. I should have realized. And again, sir, I don't mean any disrespect whatsoever, but somehow my question didn't get answered. The people of Calcutta under Sister Teresa died of dysentery, died of things that were curable. My question is why weren't they cured? I mean, we're talking about the Catholic Church, an organization that has more money than countries or anybody else, the richest organization in the world. Now, I by no means want to disrespect Sister Teresa, a humanitarian, a wonderful person, but at the same time, I see a disparity in this somehow, that all she did was help them die when she was part of a group that could have helped him live. Would you please answer my question, sir?
Sure. Well, I would doubt that the Catholic Church is the richest organization in the world. But apart from that, the particular aim or call, say, of the House for the Dying was for those who were dying, actually, to die with respect and dignity, having, if they lived like animals, at least they died like angels, is one of the stories that were going around. So the aim was to give, and the aim was not to have a hospital, because others would have a hospital. That the particular aim of the Home for the Dying was for those who were really dying. And from the medical care that was given, not all of the people died. And even now, a good number of people are moved to other houses of the sisters, or they go back to their families after. So there are doctors that visit the Home for the Dying every day. There are nurses. They do receive the medical care, not in the hospital, because Mother Teresa was very much against establishing big institutions, because her thinking was that if the institution becomes big or becomes institutional, then she and the sisters would lose that personal touch with the people, so that someone that gets better from the care that they do receive, then they will go to another home that the sisters have, or they will go back to the families, or if there was really something that another hospital could take care of, then they would go there.
I think, Father, probably the question that is foremost in people's minds is that why isn't the Vatican actually doing more? Mother Teresa was a revered woman all over the world. She won the prize for humanitarianism, the Nobel Peace Prize for that. She was loved. She had influence. And even with her influence, many felt that the Vatican could certainly offer more in the area of financial responsibility in these areas.
Right.
And I think that's probably the question, more than...
Okay.
than.
Right. Well, the Vatican itself is more an administrative center. And now they also do have a department in the Vatican called Cor Unum that is involved directly in assistance. But also to keep in mind that most of the work of that kind that is done by the church is done on a local level. So if you look throughout all the places in all the different countries in the world, or all, each diocese, I think almost every diocese in the world has what's called Catholic charities, or other kind of many religious and sisters, nuns, priests, and brothers, and lay people are very much committed in doing all kinds of work that does serve the poor. So that is the work of the Catholic Church. It's not just the Vatican that is supposed to do everything, but on the contrary, what is done really on the local level. And with there is as well what's called Peter's Tent. So it is a collection that's taken in all the churches, Catholic churches throughout the world, and that money is given to the Vatican, and that goes out into charitable purposes.
Our next question is from Sue from Massachusetts. Sue, will you please come and give your question to Father Brian?
Yes, thank you, Brian, for being with us here tonight. It's highly appreciative. I'm curious of one thing. Why, you know, I'm looking at Mother Teresa, and I have met Mother Teresa, by the way. I met her at the John Quincy Suite in the John Hancock Center in Boston, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, and I was very impressed by her, by the way. I'm curious about this one thing. My curiosity is that why did not the scientific community, why did not the scientific community actually put their efforts into helping Mother Teresa to stop the atrocities in Calcutta rather than just helping people die? And this is my question. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Well, you know, the Hope for the Dying was one aspect of the work in Calcutta. This is of other homes and other work. For example, there is the home for children, or Sri Shababan. And there, they will take little babies that are either abandoned, not wanted, for whatever reason. And there, they, you know, any time there's about, just in Calcutta alone, there's 300 babies or little children, and that they are available for adoption. So there's the dying is just one thing. I was saying before that those who really are already beyond any medical possibilities, that, you know, even if you took them to the hospital, they wouldn't be able to receive the treatment in order to have their lives saved. So for those people, and then the other people that they can help, either from whatever the treatment that they can give, or at least to send them for other further treatment, so that is also the aim and purpose.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, Father Brian. Excuse me for being with us tonight. I apologize for my throat this evening, sir. It has been an honor and a pleasure. Good luck with the process. I know it's going to be a long and arduous one. And for those of you who join us regularly, we have many people upcoming in the People Speak. Shannon Lee, daughter of Bruce Lee. Congressman Paul Assembly was just with us. Congressman Ron Paul, Joan Baez, Arlo Guthrie, Mark Watts, and Senator Barack Obama. Next week's guest is Pete Seeger, the legendary folk singer and activist. He'll be our guest on The People Speak at 8 o'clock Eastern, August 7th on Tuesday. Thank you all for being here, and great questions, great having you. Thank you, Father Brian, so much.
You're most welcome.
Good night, everybody.
This
the show's over.
Is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. I roamed and I rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert, and all around me voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me.